Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon, good morning, whichever time zone you're in. This is Stacey Giovanni, and I am honored today to have Bill Murray with me. He's talking about being the founder of the National Association for Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. It's a non-for-profit organization focused on providing a voice and resources to help victims of child abuse. It's much needed in this day and time today. Bill, are you with me?
I am. Here I am. Thank you very much for having me.
Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for being on Empowerment Radio for you. I am so honored to have you on my show. You know, I've given you a brief intro, but you know what? I'm going to put you on the spot, and I'm going to put the mic to the mouth of the founder and let you just talk about what's going on. I'd love to hear about your foundation. I think that's what I kind of like to start with first, if you'd be so kind as to expound on that.
Sure. Well, I'd be happy to. I've been an activist for a while in my local community, but I've also been in recovery from child abuse for over 30 years now, and I was not talking about that issue publicly. Of course, I talked about it when I met with people and meetings and groups and one-on-one, but not in public. But a few years ago, I fulfilled a promise to myself that I wouldn't go public until my parents were both deceased. They had no knowledge of the abuse while it was going on and were not my abusers. And when they were told in my late 20s that what had happened to me, they were absolutely shocked. My father almost had a heart attack. He couldn't believe it. So I knew that if they found out that I was talking about this publicly, it would upset them. And I promised myself I'd wait until they were gone. And that happened a few years ago now. And when it happened, my father had my sister had passed on, and my mother had gotten very serious Alzheimer's, so I knew she wasn't going to be able to understand what was going on. She wouldn't know. And I began talking about the fact that I was an abused child, and from that grew the desire to actually get really active. And one of the reasons was I tried to find any kind of local group or help for me, and at the time, I was living in Florida near my mother. I have my permanent residence here in Los Angeles, where I'm sitting today. But she had been in a senior citizen, senior living home, and that's where I was. And I couldn't find anything, nothing at all. And it really was surprising to me. So I said, well, there's an obvious need here. And I launched a website called the National Association for Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, NASCA. And it's a grassroots, not-for-profit organization. It's not a 501c3 yet, but it is an organization that receives no funding from any other outside group or belongs to any other outside group. We do everything out of our own pockets at this point. And for this last several years, we've developed, I believe it's pretty close to 30 different programs or services that are all free to the public on the basis of the energy and the talents of the volunteers who have come forward and self-declared, which is how you do it, that they are members of the NASCA family. There's no registration. There's no signing up. There's no card to carry. There's no dues to pay. It's a self-declared membership, and we have also included the group of people that have been on some of our talk shows. As you know, you've been on our show. You yourself are a member of the NASCA family. We designate people, obviously, who give us anything, any kind of energy, and if you give us 90 minutes of your time, that matters. So we call you a member of our family, any of the hundreds of special guests we've had as well. But the programs, that's just one of the programs, the radio show, and we've done 1,400 episodes. So we're really diligent at this, just six nights a week on that. But again, it's only one of the many projects that we do, and I'd be happy to go through any of them that you'd like me to describe. But the best way for people to see it is to go on our website at NASCA.org, and if they want to see sort of the thumbnail, the sketch of all the programs that we do, on the front page of the website, there are three red arrows that point to the link that will take them to the right page. It's called the highlights page. And there's certainly over two dozen programs there, all of them free services, and they're in a list form, so they're easy to scroll through. And you can see, you can see why I'm so proud of the membership, because this is an effort of a lot of volunteers and people who have given their time. And while we don't belong to anybody else, we cooperate with everybody. And we include everybody, and we include all types of abuse. So it's, you know, this is for people who experienced not only sexual assault, but also violent abuse or physical trauma, emotional trauma or mental problems, neglect or maltreatment, and so on. And we know, and both sexes, obviously, and every walk of life is involved, and all ethnic types, and we're really now. Even internationally followed by, because this is a worldwide problem, I imagined that the original core group would be Americans. It turns out to be North Americans. That's the core group. But we are nonetheless being found by anybody that speaks English around the world, and they're really joining us as well. So we're really, really happy with where we've come in just a few years, all of it out of our own energy, not belonging to anybody, but cooperating with everybody. We have thousands on our website, thousands of resources, hundreds and hundreds of articles, many, many tools, and of course, as I say, about close to 30 of our own programs or services that are all free to the public. So that's just a brief, I'll discuss any of them you like, of course, but that's just a brief uh-huh. thumbnail of what NASCA is all about. We do two things, by the way. But we are here to educate the public. Okay, so that's the non-abused public, the public who usually runs away from these topics. We want to give them a place where they can come, and there's all kinds of information about the many, many issues of child abuse and trauma that they can find and read up about, and we want to break through that taboo. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, to reach out, as you said, to anyone who has experienced a child abuse or trauma, and especially those who have never experienced any kind of recovery. In fact, you know, Stacy, very well that a lot of people don't even realize the main problem of their life stems back to what they experienced in youth, and it's the foundation of their life. So all their decisions and choices and relationships and places they've lived and careers they've chosen and problems they've gotten into, a lot of them can be traced right back to that. And if they've never dealt with that, then, you know, it's still sitting there waiting for them to find the way to talk about it, you know, because that's really a really central issue. The keeping of a secret is something almost 100% of us do as we come into adulthood for a variety of reasons. We're ashamed, we're in pain, we're angry, we feel broken, we feel less than, we're embarrassed, we know we'll be judged in our head, you know, and for all kinds of reasons. Mm-hmm. We keep this secret, and of course, that's the worst thing you can do. The solution really begins, I believe, in the transition from being a victim into survivorship, even if it's been 20 and 30 and 40 years since your last abuse, by telling your story for the first time in an appropriate setting, and then making a commitment to keep, you know, working perhaps in that same setting, but certainly working on yourself and making, you know, consistent progress is what it's all about. But this telling of the story is to me the bridge between victimhood and survivorship, and then there's a lot of work to do, obviously, once you've done that, but it has to be in an appropriate, in an appropriate way, with a counselor, with a minister, with a group, with a sponsor, you know, whatever. Maybe a good friend sometimes, but
you know, and I agree with that, because It happens that way a lot of times, and in working with abuse issues, and I work with addiction issues too in my practice. You know, you find it in a personal setting with myself as well. You know, we don't even realize why we do a lot of the things when we're adults, because we don't understand, number one, that we were a victim of child abuse. And I think that it's important to clarify that, you know, you don't have to be beaten or starved or anything. Emotional abuse can be just as traumatic and have
right.
just as the same devastating effects on us as adults as the mm-hmm. physical abuse.
And we, you know, we recognize that. And because of that, you know, one of the things I was very surprised about was that many of the organizations that I was able to run into, and most of them are kind of local efforts, and that's appropriate. Most work, the actual work happens locally. But a lot of them gave no acknowledgement of any other kind of abuse except sexual assault. And I knew there were a lot of people out there suffering from child abuse trauma that had no sexual element to it. But they might have been beaten badly. They might have been witnessing their mother being beaten in a domestic violence home they grew up in. That's emotional trauma. They might have been bullied really badly. They might have been neglected. You know, there are kids that are chained to the cellar, to the pipe in the cellar for the afternoon
yeah.
because their mother's got to go shopping. I mean, this is ridiculous. But it happens all the time.
Yeah.
And these kids grow up, you know, very badly injured and scarred. And it's the kind of scar that doesn't show up on the outside because it's inside scars, of course. and they have every
That's
right
true.
to recover, too. And so our organization handles, we acknowledge and try to help everybody we can, no matter what kind of trauma they experience.
You know, and I also agree with you because I'm on the Speakers Bureau for RAIN, which is a sexual assault division outside of in Washington, D.C. And,
sure.
You know, I talk about sexual assault. I talk about child abuse, and I talk about the dialogue that people have with someone that is that has suffered sexual assault. And, you know, I try to reach out to as many people as I can, and I can't begin to tell you, Bill, how many times I've gone to a women's organization to speak for free and educate them, and sometimes I get this conversation, well, we don't want to talk about that. That's a dark subject. Hello?
Right.
It's reality.
Right. That's right. You know, the typical person who is not an abuse survivor themselves, who's not experienced abuse, will tell you, well, it doesn't happen in my neighborhood. That's what they'll say. Or they'll say, it's never been in our family. You know, or they'll say, I don't know anybody that's been abused. But, of course, Stacey, we know from the statistics that all three of those statements are impossible. Impossible.
Exactly.
Because statistically speaking, when you have the official number that we use the federal government's number, okay, and they say 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys, and they say that's probably a conservative figure because child abuse is one of the least reported crimes there is, but that's their best guess. Well, that's 1 out of 5 of our kids. In other words, 20% of our children, which means since all of them eventually become 18 and adults, that 20% of our adult population, and this is just the sexual assault figures, you know, have experienced sexual abuse in their past. Only a few, a tiny few of us, like you and I, have gotten into recovery and furthermore gotten far enough into our recovery that we're comfortable enough to actually talk about it, you know, in a sane, calm way, you know, but passionate way, and try to use our story to reach out to others, which is what we're doing here today. But the vast majority of the adult survivors, 20% of the population, are keeping a secret. And that's why a person will say, it's not in my community. They just don't know who they are. And that's why they'll say, it's not in my family. They just don't know who they are. And that's why they'll say, I don't know anybody. But you certainly know every 100 people you know, 20 of them, if that statistic is right, have an abuse past. You just don't know who they are.
You know? Exactly. And they don't.
Just,
they won't know.
Just,
they They won't know, Bill, because they don't feel comfortable because they know what that attitude is in the family, and they don't feel comfortable coming forward and telling anyone. And if there is no place for them to go to get their voice being heard, then that's something that they unfortunately may take to their grave. And that is a sad, sad, tragic thing to, and something to think about.
Right, because the suffering continues. It gets worse. And it never gets resolved unless, you know, you find a path. And there are lots of them. We don't promote just one way. There's lots of ways to enter into healing. And there's, you know, for example, ministry and psychiatry and psychology and counseling and life coaches and 12-step programs and nonprofits that have their own method. And, you know, writing is a technique that helps a lot of people. Art therapies, hypnosis. You know, there's lots and lots of things that can be done. But unless you start, you're going to be stuck in the suffering that you've been feeling ever since the abuse occurred. In other words, you started feeling it in your childhood. In the instant that the abuse occurred, I started feeling it. And for me, it was sheer shock. I turned into a stone. I didn't know what the guy was doing to me. And I had no knowledge of anything sexual at all. I knew that that nobody had ever touched me like that before, and I turned into a stone, a statue. You know, I froze, and then I was trapped, and I couldn't get away, and I didn't know what to do, and I was confused. And that's just the beginning of, you know, all the feelings that I've had about the abuses that I went through for many years, and now into my adulthood. You know, I dragged them right into my adulthood, determined to keep the secret. You know, and that turned out to be absolutely the wrong path, which fortunately over 30 years ago I discovered, and I started down the healing journey I'm still on, you know, and still hopefully making progress.
Well, you know, and I think in working in the substance abuse field, I had 35 women on my caseload, and I brought my women's abuse program into that facility. And I found that 95, because I did my own survey on the women that came in there, and 95% of the women that came into that substance abuse program had some kind of abuse issue. And 75% of the women in my group whatsoever had never even spoken about it. So the bottom line is the addiction was just the mask to be able to hide the pain. That was just, it was the way that they dealt with hiding the pain.
Right. Well, it was for me. I'm also an alcoholic and drug addict, but I'm in recovery over 30 years. But we all choose obsessive and compulsive behaviors of various types, all kinds of them. Sometimes it's substance abuses, but sometimes it's workaholism, and sometimes it's overeating, and sometimes it's, you know, gambling addictions, whatever it is. We are compulsive, and we do this to cover up. Well, I'll talk about me. I know that I did it because I hated Bill. I hated how I felt, and I hated who I was. And so as soon as it was possible, out of high school and into college, I drank like a fish. I never drank socially, Stacy. I drank for oblivion. You know, and that's how I drank. And I threw up a lot, and I passed out, and I had blackouts. And I learned that after a couple of years of that adding some drugs to my diet, I didn't pass out as often, didn't throw up as much, and I still, you know, I still drank too. But I became a chemist, you know, drinking and using. The point was that I was trying to avoid Bill. I hated myself. And that did temporarily work. It was a temporary solution for the next decade or a little more. I used a lot of other things too. I used, because all my abusers had been men, I used being, you know, sleeping around a lot with many, many women, because I was trying to prove my sexuality to myself. I never had felt attracted to men, yet that was the only people that had come on to me when I was being abused, and that was really confusing. So one of my obsessions was to sleep with as many girls as I could in my 20s, you know, and I did really pretty well. And then that didn't work anymore, you know. And I came to a place where I realized that I didn't know that it was related to my child abuse so much as I knew I had a problem with drinking, certainly, and that I better go see about getting help. And I too fell in with a substance abuse organization, a 12-step program, AA, and started on the path that was to become not only my path to sobriety and being clean, but also I applied those same materials to, recovery from the child abuse, the 12-step program, the same process, the design for living, as we say, to my child abuse from the beginning. Because, there was nothing else that many years ago, especially for boys, there was nothing. And AA turned out to be, a lifeboat for me. And fortunately, they let me talk about these things in the group. That was questionable because 12-step programs have what you call a singleness of purpose, where you're only there to talk about their issue, and their issue is obviously alcohol. But when the elders in the group heard how I was sharing, they said to me, strictly speaking, we don't really talk about these issues, but on the other hand, we can hear how, the way you're explaining it, an awful lot of your drinking was done on account of your experience. So it is your experience. And although we don't understand it, we also know that there might be other people coming in here who need to hear what you're saying. So you keep sharing about it and keep coming back. They gave me permission to talk about my child abuse. And so from then on, it's always been a part of my story. It is my story. Uh-huh. That's where I came from. And it's why I drank. And even recovering from drinking after a while wasn't enough. I had to keep working on myself because I'm the problem, and I carry the problem with me. And you can't move away from it. That's another thing people try to do is what we call a geographic, which means that mm-hmm. they move from one part of the country to the other, trying to get away right. from their life. And they discover that you can't leave your life behind because it's in you. Wherever you go, there you are, and you're the problem. So the geographic doesn't work usually for any length of time, and it didn't for me either.
Bill, would you do me a favor and would you talk to the men and the boys that may be listening out there that sure. are victims of child abuse? Because you know what? I don't think that there's enough available for the men that have suffered that to be able to start their healing process.
Well, we guys are fortunate today in a way that I was on my own pretty much way back when, but that's not true today. There is more of an understanding that little boys can be abused too, and that's new. I mean, it's fairly new. When I was looking for even before I got into AA, I talked to a psychiatrist with my parents present and told them the story. I didn't get any help from him. He didn't understand the issue. I didn't get help from anybody. My parents were so shocked; they thought it had happened to them. Their response was, "How could this have happened to us? It didn't happen to them. It happened to me." But they weren't going to be helpful. So I went to some rape hotline places and family planning type places because that was the closest I could find. And they treated me like I was the enemy, and they actually, I felt like they were holding up a cross to Dracula and they were saying, back, get away. And they really drove me away. So today though, there is an acknowledgement, fortunately, that this is not just a problem for girls and women, but also for boys and men. And it's okay for us to come forward. Now, we were not taught this. Anybody that's anywhere near as old as I am was always taught, and it's probably still being taught to most boys, that they have to be tough, that they have to handle things by themselves, that they have to figure their own way out, that they can put things behind them. That, just get over it is told to us a lot. And these are all things that'll never happen. We can't put it behind us. It's so much a part of who we are And you don't just get over it. You don't just forget it. You don't just put it behind you. You actually have to deal with it. There are a couple of organizations that are national that are known. One of them is Male Survivor, and the other is One in Six that I can think of off the top of my head, who are uniquely trying to help address this issue in different ways. But we are at NASCA as well, because as I said, we acknowledge that that people of both sexes and who are gay and lesbian and transgendered and from every walk of life will experience this 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys statistic, no matter where they're from. Doesn't matter if you're from, you know, the big city, the suburbs, or a farm. You know, it's the same kind of statistics. So little boys who grew up knowing, thinking that they had to deal things for themselves have to understand that that was bad advice. It was really bad advice, and it's incorrect. That the way to deal with this is, as I said before, for all of us, giving up our story to an appropriate setting. For example, with a person like Stacy, a counselor or a therapist, or maybe in a group, which I really appreciated that I had a group, you know, to go to, because everybody there was dealing with their own issues, and I didn't have to worry about being judged. They were all there too for the same reason. That's one of the biggest problems for boys, is because of this bad message that we received about us being able to overcome anything that we put our mind to. We think that we'll be thought of as kind of broken people, not worthy people. Our self-esteem is in the pity pot to begin with. And so we need to be amongst others who are recovering, men and women, I think. I frankly don't recommend, this just for me, it's my personal opinion, I don't recommend that you get really, really involved with a single, because it's everybody's problem, and that actually exacerbates, would for me, the time that it would take for me to acknowledge that I'm just a person, and people of every walk of life, as I'm saying, acknowledge this. So maybe at first it would be helpful to share with a man or with a men's group, but after that, I prefer to, you can still use that if it helps you, but there are no issues I've discovered that I can't discuss in a mixed setting, although I felt that there were at the beginning. So I acknowledge that it may feel that way at the beginning, but you may find out later that we all have the same issues, basically, you know. So men and boys, take heart. We're here to help you, too, just as we are to help anybody. And it's exactly the same process that anybody would use, that you'll use. It's not separate for men, but you do have to give up the anchor that's around your neck, given when you were a kid, that said you have to do this by yourself, this thing called life by yourself. That's a lie. We are all in this together. I don't know if you wanted me to speak to anything more specific for men. They often have the issue that I had, that I described earlier, as being sexually confused, you know, about their own sexuality. Because after all, I was molested by all men, a whole bunch of them. And I had very little experience with women, or girls, I guess I should say. And yet I didn't feel attracted to men, but I thought, well, you know, I don't want to be known as a homosexual, so I had to go prove my sexuality, and, you know, I found out, I indeed found out I liked women. But if I didn't, even if I discovered I was gay, so what? You know, that's okay, too. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a different lifestyle than maybe my parents would have wanted for me, but it's who I am, and you have to be true to who you are. So we have, you know, gay members as well, and we have lesbian members as well, and you know, they all face the same issues. Believe me, that it's not that different between the sexes. Not once you get over the first hump of it, anyway.
You know, what I like to talk about, I'm going to hit on a couple of points here, but the first thing that I want to talk about is survivors who call into your program that come on and share their stories. You know,
sure.
I think that's so needed because of they can come on without anybody knowing who they are. They can talk
right.
about what's going on without being judged, and that may be the very start of them to be able to really feel comfortable to seek some help and get out here and do something to heal.
Well, you're absolutely right. And everything we do, by the way, at NASCA is designed to encourage the community to engage, everything. But, of course, that's true with the radio show as well. While we plan ahead and schedule a month in advance usually for our special guests and so forth and the themes for the shows and so forth, anytime that someone comes on and tells us that they've never told their story before, everything else goes out the window, and that becomes the focus of the group that night. Because there's nothing more important to us than a newcomer getting an opportunity to ask any question they want, to share anything that they want, to know that we're there for them. And it's usually it becomes a quiet show with other focus, and they and I do most of the talking. But sometimes, of course, I ask the panel, we almost always have two or three extra people there with us to chime in, and they know, too, that this is the most special kind of show we ever do. When we have somebody who you know, commences their sharing by saying, you know, I've been listening to your show for two or three weeks, and I've really gotten a lot out of what all the people have said and so forth, and so I decided to call in because I've never told my story before, and I think I can trust you guys to tell my story. Well, that's a huge compliment. And one of our biggest problems is we have a broken truster. You know, we can't trust, none of us. So if they do that, the show becomes about them. And as you say, they can do it anonymously. They don't have to tell us even where they're from, although I do encourage them to give us a little bit of a idea of, you know, they can say their first name or not, but where they're from or not, doesn't matter. They can stay anonymous if they wish. And I just gently lead them through a few questions that encourage them to, you know, reveal whatever they're willing to reveal. I never push them. We don't give a huge amount of advice on those shows. We do thank them for their story because that's, you know, that's giving us too, and we welcome them to our NASCA family for having done so. And these are the most special shows we have. But everything we do, I get tons of emails, phone calls, and other kinds of communications besides the show where people are looking for advice, looking for a group that they can attend, asking me specific questions about certain aspects of child abuse or trauma and so forth, and we answer them all and right away. We don't want anybody hanging. In fact, there's 30 of us on the website at NASCA under the contact page who deliberately have volunteered to put our names, phone numbers, and email addresses on that page so that there's never a time when someone who's looking for help can't find someone to talk to. Because that was another thing I experienced was lots of groups, when you call, they have an answering machine, and they don't call you back. And when somebody's ready to share or needs to share, and they make a call, we want there to always be, you know, a possibility to hook up with one of us on that list of 30. They might not get the first person or the second, but they're gonna find one of those 30 people home and answering the phone. And besides, if they leave a message, I will call them back, and I always do. So we never leave anybody hanging that's a newcomer. The most important thing in a 12-step program is the newcomer, and that's true with us too. You know, they're the lifeblood. And they're the reason we do it.
Well, you know, and I think it's important, too. On my last show, my guest and I talked about human trafficking. And mm-hmm. children are prevalent for predators when it comes to human trafficking. And
yep.
not just girls, boys, too. And,
yes.
you know, I mean, if you're in a situation, and the reason I really wanted to talk about being able to talk anonymously with your radio show or with your volunteers is that if they're in a situation that could be a dangerous situation, they do not want to feel that they're in a situation that could put them in danger. And I think that's really important to let the listening audience know that there is a place that they can talk to, that they don't have to worry about their names being divulged or being public with what's going on, but they do have a place that they can actually talk to someone and start getting some help.
Well, we'll help in any way we can. Our focus is really not on the children in that sense. We're not like a helpline for kids, but we are for adult survivors. And a lot of adult survivors are in the same situation you just described where they're
right.
They're perhaps still living with their predator. You know, maybe their experience, you know, beatings from their husband, or they still live in the hometown with their dad who was their molester, or, you know, or the minister is still at the, you know, in the church. Whatever it is, they feel threatened by, you know, being discovered, or perhaps there's a custody case going on. Whatever, for whatever reason, they're they don't have to ever tell us who they are. They don't want to. Now most people do. I mean, 99.9% end up telling us, and actually are grateful that they do, because they do trust that we're never going to use it against them for sure. But what we do for children is. There's just sort of two parts to our mission. One is to reduce the amount of abuse that's going on in today's world, the at-risk kids for today's world. But we don't do that by speaking to the kids. We do it by speaking to the adults. We teach the adults how to train their kids to be less likely to be a victim, to empower them with knowledge right from toddlership, starting at toddlership, that they have the right to say no, that their body is theirs, that there are dangers in the world, that if anything ever feels uncomfortable to them, they should come to a trusted person, usually mom and dad. But what if it's dad that's the molester? Then you have to go to somebody else. And keep telling until you're heard and you get the help you need. So that's all prevention. And it's up to the adults to give that to the kids, because the kids start out like a blank slate. They don't know, like I didn't know, even what was happening. At age 11, I'd never been taught anything about sex. So when I was touched by the man for the first time, I turned into stone, and I didn't even know what it was. So that's one thing we do. Second thing is we teach intervention. And again, we teach this to adults. Adults need to recognize not only, obviously, physical signs like bruises and bleeding. And by the way, if you see bleeding, that's a 911 call right then. But there are many, many, let's say, non-physical signs that a child may be having, may be going through a difficult time. For example, changes in their behavior, their performance, maybe their school grades drop dramatically, their willingness to hang around certain kinds of people or a certain person. Their attitude about life changes. And there's a whole list of these that's on our website, too, under the resource button. The first page of the resource button is where we discuss some of the things to look for, about 15 of them maybe, and that's an incomplete list, but it gives you an idea of the things to look for in a young child that would be indicators of something maybe wrong with their life. And then a second list for slightly older children. The behavior changes because the child is more empowered just because they're getting older to do other kinds of behaviors. And you look for these things, and when you see one or two, it could be just because they're adolescents and they're growing up, but if you see four or five, or you know, it means it's an invitation for you as the adult to talk to that child and see if you can glean, you know, something from them that they've been keeping a secret. And as soon as you get the suspicion, the next thing we teach on that page is what to do with it, how to report it. Because it's not up to us, to take our own action. We're not the law enforcement agency, but there are groups that are tasked with that, and they want to hear from us. So they want to hear our suspicion. And that's when you make the call, when you have a suspicion, not when you have proof positive. You know, uh-huh. The law enforcement group or the Center for Child Protection or whatever, Family Services, they'll go and get the proofs, and that's their job. So those two things are really for trying to do the first thing that we, the first part of our mission, which is to reduce the incidence of child abuse that's going on today. And, of course, we're educating the public along the way as we do this. Second part of our mission, as we've said, is to offer this concept of healing and hope to them. You know, it's 42 million American adults, that's the official number, who have been sexually abused in their childhood, who are now adults. And, of course, that's, again, considered a conservative number, and they say it right on the page the government puts it out on, that because we don't know exactly how many cases there are, this is based on reported cases, and child abuse being one of the worst reported crimes there is. But still, 42 million is a huge chunk of our population, and most of these people are not in recovery. We want them to hear the message that man, woman, you know, gay, straight, whatever, you know, Jew, Gentile, and Muslim, you're all a part of this, and all of us are susceptible, and there are people in every category who experience child abuse and trauma who need to have the hope offered to them.
Exactly.
So recovery.
Abuse does not discriminate.
No.
It does not discriminate. You know, what I'd like to do briefly is, we've got a little while here. I'd like to talk about your resources that you have available with your organization, Bill.
Yeah, can I just go back? I know I didn't really address the one thing you just said that I think you started off on, which was trafficking. Okay. And and this happens to be Trafficking Abuse Month, Awareness Month. So it's worth saying that there are a variety of reasons that kids become trafficked. And, of course, kids and women are the most trafficked. There are some men that are trafficked, too. But just talking in terms of the biggest groups, by far, it's the women and kids. A lot of them are trafficked for sexual reasons. To be put into prostitution, for example. Others are trafficked because they're part of the labor force that somebody desires, so that's also part of the story of trafficking. But we're here to talk about, and that's traumatic too, and it matters, believe me. But a lot of kids we're now starting to use the term trafficked, and I think more appropriately, for children that we used to refer to as child prostitutes. These are kids who many times, they're actually not plucked off the street from their hometown. They're runaways. And they go to some foreign city to them. They take $200 with them thinking they're going to be satisfied with that. And, of course, it runs out really fast. They end up in a train station, wondering what, or a bus station, bus depot. And there are predators out there that are actually looking for these kids. And when they see somebody like that, they go and they befriend them. And they offer them a hamburger, and they say, do you have a place to stay? And, Jesus, it's terrible what you're sharing with me that you've gone through at home. And they convince the child by grooming them in this way to go with them, and then they're trafficked. The adult, of course, always has the control in these situations, and the child is completely vulnerable and innocent, but the adult then will turn them out and put them on the street. We used to call these kids child prostitutes. They're actually working for a pimp, you know, and obviously for the appetite of the John who uses their services. and they are innocent. The criminals are the pimps and the Johns, and the children are victims, and we're now more appropriately calling them trafficked kids. So that's another big group of kids that, you know, we need to understand are out there, and they're in every city, and they're not only in cities, they're also at major sporting events. We're dealing with this for the Super Bowl again, but not just the Super Bowl, which is, you know, an obvious place, but many of the trade conventions that visit Las Vegas or any city attract a lot of men to the conventions, and because of that, that's the pool of prospective clients that an unscrupulous pimp will take sometimes a group of kids to these events and put them up in motel rooms and offer them as sexual slaves for the night or the hour or whatever it is to the men that go to these conventions. And those are trafficked Harvey Sue kids, trafficked kids too. They're trapped in this situation. And now they've even worse horror stories to recover from. And we do try and find them, and we do try to offer, you know, whatever we can. And a lot of our adult people who have been on our show, many of them are, in fact, I am, you know, in a sense. I had a 2-week period of time when I was taken out, and I didn't know where I was, and I was, you know, offered over and over to other pedophiles, and it was just horrible. That was only 2 weeks for me. I can only imagine if you had to do that for 2 years on the street, you know. And we do have guests who come on and talk about this as part of their background. And it's amazing how honest our guests are, Stacey, as you know. But they are ready and willing to tell their story because they know that it's possible that in telling their story, they'll give somebody else the courage to come forward and start talking about theirs. And that's all they do it for, you know. To help somebody else.
Yeah, I talked to, I actually had someone that I had talked to about being on my show, and she was a victim of trafficking. And, you know, it was a sad situation because she didn't have anyone to really talk to about this, and she was judged, and she really didn't know who to turn to. You know, she went to the police, and the police looked at her as not a victim, but, you know, a criminal. And it's a sad situation, and I think that it really needs to be addressed. You know, she was 23 years old, and she just, I mean, she'd been out there since she was like 16, 17,
right.
I think something to that
right.
effect. And now she's
yep.
an adult, and she's just beside herself because she wants out. She doesn't know. She finally got away from her perpetrators, but... You know, she doesn't, how do you find your identity, you know, after going through something like that? That's the problem. You lose your identity. They strip you away from your control. They strip your identity away. They strip your self-esteem away. They strip your confidence. They strip everything and leave you a shell. And where do you go to rebuild that person? How do you even find that person again? I think that's a lot of problems that people run into when they've been victims of abuse like that. They don't have a clue how to reinvent themselves into who they really are.
Well, and society has no tool for this to occur. Of all those children out there, she's 23 years old. There are some resources for her, and I can talk about that too. But when we're talking about the children that are brought in, say from a sweep of a red light district, and they find some kids that are underage who have been prostituting themselves, there's no fix for that. There's no way to deal with that. The best they do is send the kid home. And as I illustrated earlier in the description of the example I gave, a lot of these kids are runaways to begin with. There's something going on at home that they ran away from. Sending them home doesn't fix it. And what we really need is, and it's only available, I'd say there's less than a couple hundred total beds in the country that do this. And that's probably an overinflated number, but there is a sensitivity in some of the communities that without a transition period that has to be a significant, you know, pouring in of program to the people the kids that are brought in from the street, they're doomed to go right back at best. So there are a few places, but there need to be thousands more that would bring a child in, let them stay for a significant amount of time, perhaps reentering them into the idea that they are part of the social structure, that school, they need to continue their schooling, that somebody cares about them, that they're in a group of people that are going through the same situation, and I'm talking about it could take weeks and weeks and weeks of kind of deprogramming them, because after all, these kids, like your 23-year-old, all they know is how to use sex to make a living, and they know that really well. They've been taught that really well, and so it's really typical for a child to return to the street or to some other sex working, like well, stripping or being a call girl, to try to get off the street by going on, you know, Craigslist. Well, that's really the same thing, you know. And that's what they know. So you have to give them, you know, another option so that they feel enough self-esteem to follow it and to realize in the end that they are worthwhile and that people do care and that they can trust at least the small group to begin with and maybe a bigger group after that, and that it's okay that they have a background like ours that's less than, you know, stellar. It's painful to even think about and certainly to feel. But this is something, this is a service that we have not yet come up with in sufficient numbers to even put a tiny dent in the statistics of children who are trafficked for prostitution. So,
I agree, and I wish there was something available. I wish I could have a magic wand and just be able to, you know, have an outcome, a positive outcome for everybody that's gone through that, because it's a sad, sad situation. You know, we're going to be closing down here pretty soon here, and I really would like to talk about your resources that you have available, Bill.
Oh, okay. I thought, are we on for another just 10 minutes, or is it?
No, we're on for about 30 minutes, but I'd like to really go into and expound upon your resources.
All right, I just wanted a sense of timing. I don't want you to not have an opportunity to ask me whatever you want. As I said, on the main page, or we call it the highlights page of the website, which you can find by going on the front page of the NASCA website, finding the three red arrows and clicking on the link next to that. At the bottom of that page, there is a kind of a laundry list of many of the services that we offer. Now, we just started a blog, for example, that's not on here. There are some things that are missing, but we are constantly expanding the kinds of things that we do for the community, either that's looking for information about child abuse, because a lot of our members are not survivors, they're parents, or they're community members, maybe their sisters, you know, in trouble, whatever it is, and of course the survivors themselves. So we have, we do, if you want me to go down the list, I could say that we do seminars, either in person or by Skype. I've done them by Skype to groups of people if they want to arrange for that. Of course, our websites, the main one for this issue is NASCA.org. That's the home of the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. There are hundreds and hundreds of pages and thousands of links. We give away information freely. We repost feature articles. We do the news of the day. Everybody who for whom we use information gets attribution. We never claim it as ours. It's always, you know, theirs. It is theirs. And we give attribution to everybody. So there's ways to connect with any of the people that you or organizations that you see on the website as well. And the original site that I had launched as an activist was LA Community Policing, and we consider that a sister site to NASCA. It's my response to the events of 9/11 2001, and I launched it in early 2002. It discusses basically general public safety issues from originally just a local level, but no sooner was launched than it became not only national but now international. So it discusses things like as broad as national security. But as local as the Jeopardy program that they have for children who are living in communities here in Los Angeles that are underprivileged communities. And they take these kids, and they have several programs at LAPD and the Sheriff's Department to send them in a better direction, like the Explorers program is another one. So LACP is a sister site. Then we do the daily news every day on our websites, both of them, where there's articles that pertain to current events that are occurring right now, sometimes from newspaper articles, sometimes from magazines or press releases, but sometimes from government agencies. But there's a smattering of all the issues every day updated, and then we combine them all together, and it's actually the basis of our Sunday night show is all the news that's appeared in the previous week put together as possible topics that anybody can call in and discuss. And then we do, as I say, our show not only Sunday night, which is a two-hour show, but five additional shows. So 6 nights a week we're on the air at 8 o'clock Eastern time, 8 p.m., or 5 o'clock Pacific. And the other shows are 90 minutes. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday generally are special guest shows. Tuesday and Thursdays are topic-driven shows. Sometimes they're open mic shows where you can call in and ask anything you want or talk about anything you want. There's almost always not only myself as the host, but a panel of people, two or three or four additional voices, and a chat room that's running. And this is another attempt to make sure that even a person who's shy about calling in has a way to share. And they can be in the chat room and be anonymous. They can pick a silly name, you know, for a chat name, and type anything they want in there. And when we type, we're in there too, and we type back and forth. And anything that's appropriate, I bring up on the air for that person, and maybe ask their question or make their comments for them on the air. So the 6-night-a-week radio show, that's just one of the programs, but we've done 1,400 episodes, and we archive them all. So every one of them is recorded and available later, and there's a huge library because of this, with hundreds of special guest shows where you can go back and you can pick out by the guest name or the group they're with or the book they've written or the issues they've talked about. It's about a 250 to 300-word description of each show that goes with the show. And you know what the show's going to be about before you click on it. But when you do click on it, it plays on demand. Then we have a service that's perhaps our most popular, and that is a list of every recovery group and service that we know of, we can find, in the English-speaking world. Now, this was originally going to be just for the United States. But once we finished all 50 of the states, we included then the Canadian provinces. And once we'd included that, we said, well, we might as well go on and do Australia and UK and New Zealand. And now that we've done, and on all the English-speaking countries, we discovered a whole lot of them in Africa. And they all have services. So we list all these countries, and now we're going back and we're speaking, we're listing the countries that you normally wouldn't, well, English is not their primary language, for example, France or Germany. And there are many services that are offered in English because that's their second language. You know, almost every German is taught English when they grow up, so they have a lot of services in English. And this has thus become a truly global list of recovery groups and services. We don't list individual therapists because there are tools in existence to do that. But as far as we know, no one has ever attempted to do a list of every recovery group and service in the world, but we've done it with volunteers. And it's taken us a couple of years, but we are really proud of this. And it's an interactive list, by the way. So if you live in Minnesota, you go to the United States, then you go to Minnesota, you click on it, and you see there's a group that you're aware of that's not listed. All you do is write to the volunteer that keeps the list, and she instantly updates it and sends it back to me, and I post it. And sometimes within a few hours, the list is updated. This is a constant, ongoing thing. So the lists are living lists, and they depend on the interaction with our followers, our public, to improve a broken link, a corrected phone number, or a new group, and so forth. It's one of our most popular services, and obviously it fulfills a huge need for people who are out there, especially early on, and they're confused about, you know, is there a place for me to go? Then we talk, like I say, about, and we have information about prevention and intervention programs, the things that I described a few minutes ago, where we teach adults, how to talk to their children from the most youngest age. As soon as they start to talk, you can start to give them some of this information. For example, we recommend that the actual body part names are given to a child, not the nickname, not a pee-pee, but a penis. You know, then it's not an embarrassment. Child grows up knowing they have a forehead and an eyeball and a penis. And that's no big deal. It's not a funny name on the playground that they learn someday and a dirty word, you know. And then as they grow, there are tools that you can add. There are children's books that are very good that you can read to them before they can read. Then there's materials that once they can read, that you can introduce that they can have themselves and entertain themselves with. And then, of course, we also are believers in someday, hopefully, there will be a protocol for teaching this in schools, recognizing that by far most children are abused by a family member or an extended family member, and therefore they're not going to get prevention information through their home life. They need to get it at school. And that's just a statistical fact that, you know, we're very aware of what so-called stranger danger is, and that's the man in the trench coat who's in the bushes at a park. But that's only 7% of the group of people who are predators. 93% of the predators are either family members, as I said, and that's the biggest group, 60%. Or the other 30% roughly are caregivers, like teachers. In my case, it was a camp counselor, the original one. Babysitters, coaches, people who are supposed to be chosen by the parent to be trustworthy but turn out to be predators themselves. And the parents have no idea because the predator is so clever at grooming not just the child but the community around them. So that's why we believe that this ought to be taught in school as well, and we're signatories to that effort. And intervention, again, we believe it's every adult's responsibility to care for every child and to watch out for every child, because all the children are innocent and they don't know, but we do know. And it's, you know, it's up to us to watch for children that are in trouble. Hopefully, if we learn that we have a suspicion of abuse, that we know how to turn over that tip to the appropriate authority and get the child help, because it's about 1 in 10 children in their youth get their abuse reported and perhaps get the kind of help they need starting right then, and they're still in their youth. But 9 out of 10 of us, of course, come into our adulthood with the secret, as we said before. And that's why the next thing we do, which is recovery services, is listed. We know there's many different paths to recovery, and we don't promote one over another. We promote them all. We promote the hope that there is out there, because we know there's so many different paths that, you know, that a genuinely interested person, we will help them find the appropriate path for them and continue to help them as much as they wish. We also have a couple of people who are therapists themselves that they can communicate with on occasion, and so forth. So part of us to provide recovery services, but not just in one style, but of every style we can. And there are 3 groups we've found that are willing to, that are actually seeking representation themselves, facilitators for their own style of recovery. They're all listed on the same page as the services and group page. At the bottom of that page, it says, if you can't find your own group, maybe you consider starting one yourself. And we'll help somebody start their own group according to any of those 3 organizations that we've identified. And we'll put them in touch with the right people and explain everything to them and so forth. So we actually help people start groups as well, which is a little lower on the list. But we have the contact list of members, about close to 30 of them now, on the contact page of the NASCA website. And as I said, you can look up any of them you want. There's a little description of who they are. Sometimes there's a link to their Facebook page or something as well. But and always the area they're in. So if you prefer to talk to somebody in Oregon because you're from Portland, you can do that. But if you prefer to speak to someone in Oregon because you're from New Jersey, you can do that. You know, but there's about 30 of us there, Then we have what we call the Blue Ribbon Campaign, which is an awareness campaign where we encourage the wearing of a blue ribbon, which is the color, it's like a royal blue color, that ribbon that's worn that indicates an awareness of child abuse and a willingness to discuss it, really, that's what it is. We have these available at our cost to anybody that wants them. We'll send out a few to anybody that can't afford them in bulk. But what we really hope with the Blue Ribbon Campaign is that somebody would be willing to purchase some of the blue ribbons from us and the little cards that go along with them and hand them out. Be, you know, help us with our outreach that in that way. And when I say our, I mean the community that deals with child abuse, because the blue ribbon's not for NASCA, it's for all child abuse awareness. Just like the pink ribbon is, as an example, the hot pink ribbon for breast cancer. It's the same kind of idea. Then we have a group called, well, it's a single person who has some help along the way. Michael Bouchard is doing a play called Ask a Sex Abuse Survivor. And we just thought this was so unique that we would put it under our organization, and he's one of our family members, and is delighted that we've done this. It's a one-man play, the format for which he shares on our website, and anybody can do it, where a survivor of child abuse arranges for a theatrical presentation, basically, a one-hour theatrical presentation, which is interactive with the audience that arrives. And it's done in segments. So you talk for a few minutes, then you bring the lights up and you ask if there are any questions. Then you talk for a few minutes, and you bring the lights up and you ask a few questions. You ask if there are questions. And you do this about four times or five. There's a psychologist in the audience as well who's there to help people who may have a reaction, a triggering, to talk to them, take them aside. There's materials offered at the play that you can take away, that talk about whatever the local resources are that are available. It is a unique vehicle that anybody can use who's a survivor if they want to. And Michael would be happy to have anybody contact him. And he already puts the format and all of that. I've put it on for him on the website. So that's something. Then, of course, we make our own presentations, many of us, and appearances at functions of all kinds locally. Wherever we are, there are opportunities. Sometimes we have to seek them, but they're there to speak in front of groups, sometimes small, sometimes larger, sometimes at a university class. Carol Levine, our co-host on the show, does that fairly regularly. She's got an arrangement with a couple of the local colleges where she'll talk to a few dozen students at a time, but the administration also attends, and sometimes law enforcement attends. And these are learning opportunities for them. They're kind of seminar presentations, but then they're a question and answer period. So they end up being a really informative way for kids who are considering going into psychology or maybe the legal professions or law enforcement to hear from a survivor while they're still in their educational process. But we also talk to parents. We talk to community groups. I seek opportunities whenever I can, and I'm perfectly willing to go anywhere that somebody wants me to go, and I'll even do it by Skype, as I said before, to talk to groups in any size group where we can be effective. So this public speaking aspect of it is really important. Sometimes it's for official functions. There's a group that does what they call Male Survivor Week. Male Sex Abuse Survivor Week is done by a group that's out of San Francisco, and it's been done in California up and down the coast. I've been a part of that five times, and I'm basically one of the main speaker, I guess, comes and talks about my own story and to the group of people that come to attend these, the night or the day when the biggest public event of that week goes on, and that's in December, first week of December, Male Abuse Awareness Week. Then we try to be really current with our listing of our various statistics and special reports we can find. These are all from public resources. We never create statistics. We always use the existing statistics, and they're horrible. The federal government is usually a resource for many of these, be it from the Justice Department, the FBI, the Center for Disease Control, or huge organizations like Child Health and the Center for Missing and Exploited Children that have been around for decades, who maintain these statistics, and we use their statistics. Their official statistics become the statistics that we relate on a regular basis, knowing that no matter which one of these statistics we present to a non-informed person, they'll be shocked. There's no statistic involving child abuse and trauma. It's not shocking. They're totally shocking. So we use a lot of statistics in our outreach and in our presentations. And then on occasion, I write editorials and do videos. And I'd like to do more of that, actually, if I can find the time. But we have a few of each, and it's the desire to increase that. In fact, my background, Stacy, is in film and TV, as you know, and I have all the techniques and tools and knowledge that we need to do some really good work in this area, but it's expensive. And I'm going to wait until we figure out a way to perhaps receive some funding from somebody or some donations, but this is too much money. You know, doing a really meaningful video campaign is too much money for me to ask the group to donate to, and it's more money than I have myself. So it'll have to wait until we have bigger treasury, let's say. But that's coming.
Yeah,
and
actually,
we've already done
simple things. I'm getting ready to do that here. I found a TV network that is not extravagantly expensive. I'm probably going to get some sponsors for that I'm going to be actually on the cable network and talking about these issues that you and I talked about today.
Fantastic. And that's it. I mean, we have a suspended newsletter list. We have yet to, again, find the time, really. We used to put out a monthly newsletter originally it was from the community policing effort, but then I started to including NASCA information in it, and I've just become overwhelmed, and I'm actually bringing an intern on board from one of the local colleges who's going to receive college credit for helping me a little bit, and this may be one of the things that I ask that person to pay attention to help me get that back on its legs, because it's an excellent way to reach out, and we have thousands and thousands of people in our database now. We just don't use it too much yet. And that's it. So we have our, the last thing I have listed is called advocacy and opinion in the list, and that's when, you know, we as a group have a singleness of purpose. Like I say, 12-step groups do the same thing, and frankly, to be honest, because my recovery is based on a 12-step model, so is my advocacy and my nonprofit efforts. I design them so that they fit not with the 12 steps, but with the 12 traditions, which are unique to the groups that like Alcoholics Anonymous and those that have modeled themselves after it. And even though it's not overtly stated, it is, in fact, in the background always my desire that we follow the traditions as close as possible. So that's why the only requirement for membership is a desire to recover from the abuse and trauma of your youth. You know, no other thing. You don't have to qualify. There aren't any dues or fees. We are independent of every other group, but cooperate with everybody who we can find that we believe is legitimate. We don't get into public controversies on other topics. We wouldn't, for example, discuss outside issues that sometimes they're brought up and I stop them because we don't have an opinion or we're not interested in gun control. You know, certainly
right.
It's a topic that a lot of us have opinions on, but not as a group. We're here to discuss child abuse and trauma, and, you know, to get into abortion rights or political parties or, you know, or immigration reform, all of that would start to dilute and perhaps even destroy our singleness of purpose. So when we have opinions, and we all are allowed to do that, we are allowed to do that as long as we say, this is my opinion, it's not the group's opinion. However, there are a few things that we as a group do agree, and it's easy for us to say we're on board for. For example, I mentioned one of them before was this concept of teaching children in schools what they need to know at age-appropriate levels, but all along the way, increasing it as they go, about, you know, body safety and their privacy and how secrets are bad, but surprises are good, and that mm-hmm. no one's allowed to touch them, you know, without their permission at all, ever. And if they ever feel uncomfortable about something someone's doing, they should immediately find a trusted adult. And if that first person isn't helpful, they should go tell a second adult. And if that person isn't helpful, they should keep telling, in other words, till they get the help they deserve, you know, they need and deserve. Another one would be there is a movement that's headed up by Marcy Hamilton right now. She does statute of limitation reform. She goes around the country as an attorney herself and a professor, law professor. She speaks in front of the legislatures that are all considering change, whenever they're considering changes in the statute of limitations, either criminal or civil. That's the amount of time, by the way, for people who don't know, the amount of time between when the abuse occurred, or when it stopped, I guess, and when you come forward and take and decide that you want to take an action against the perpetrator. And it can be criminal action, which results in, you know, prison time and a criminal record, or it can be civil action, which is a desire to get a monetary reward of some sort for pain and suffering, for damages. And these are two separate kinds of statutes of limitations. Every state is different from every other state, and this is another thing that we are in consensus as a group, and that is that we wish the federal government would take this issue far more seriously, and that it would see this as the pandemic that it is, and it would set up some kind of system by which all the entities they already have working on the project could interface with all of us private organizations who are out here in the local communities, perhaps coming up with some things like best practices, which so that we wouldn't have to recreate the wheel every time a new group came up. You know, some recommended information sites, some, you know, really, and put some money into public service announcements and reaching out, you know, to the public to get them over the taboo, as we said before. So that's just an example. There are a few issues, the teaching of children, the reform of statutes of limitations, some of which are just a few years, and they need to be, in our opinion, much longer, 25 years and longer. And some of them, some people believe that there shouldn't be any statute, and I can see that argument as well. But the reason is that adults often wait 10 and 20 and 30 years before they come to the conclusion that this is something I want to take action on. And they often find that the statute of limitations in their state has long ago slipped away. It's 8 years or 10 years. And they've waited 20, and there's no way they can take a person to court or sue for damages, either one. And the federal government being much more involved, I'd like them to be the centerpiece, you know, of the issue. But, you know, they don't measure it. They don't even measure it as an issue. The closest we got, the White House recently presented a program by executive order that is designed to help the girls and young women who are going to college because there's been a lot of concern about college rapes. And they made that presentation in the, I don't know if it was the Green Room, in the White House, in front of a, you know, the press, and that is going on now. That was a step, I guess, towards the right direction, but it was unfortunately not enough. First of all, they eliminated, as you said before, boys from that equation by saying girls. They specifically said girls and women. They could have used the word students, and that would have satisfied me. Because I know darn well there are boys who are experiencing sexual assault, and they don't have any part of this program because that's how it was written. I also think that a part of the program ought to be the recognition that at least 20%, as we said before, of all the kids who arrive on campus as a freshman have already been abused, and they're keeping the secret. And so part of orientation needs to be not only the warning of what might happen here on campus and what to do about it, but it also should be an opportunity to tell the youngster who's a brand new college person, boy and girl, that we on our campus are sensitive to the fact that you may have already been abused, and here are the services that we have available to you, the counseling center, the drop-in center, whatever it is. You know, there's got to be part of orientation to offer recovery already, because 20% of those kids, which is the federal statistic, have already been abused. And they've never had an opportunity given to them. Why don't you hit them right then with that, you know, as orientation? So there's a lot of short-sightedness out there. Yeah.
You know, Bill, I'm sorry, we're going to have to close here pretty soon, and I could go on for hours with you. The information you're giving is wonderful. I'd like you to end this, though, by giving your information again so that anyone that has some incline to get involved with your organization or to have a phone call with somebody or be on your radio show, they would have a way to reach you.
Okay. Well, that's easy enough. We're very involved in social media as well, but our main vehicle is the website, and the first letters of the name of the organization, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, is the web address. So it's NAASCA, S as in Sam, NAASCA.org, or .com actually, but .org. That'll get you to our website where all these things are listed that I've been describing tonight. But we also have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/NASCA. We also have a fan page for the radio show there. I have a LinkedIn and a Facebook page personally that people are free to follow and join. My information is all over the website, my personal information, but I'll give it to you here on the air. My mailing address, email address, is a version of my name, and since I'm the third in my family, I'm William. My official name is William J. Murray III. My email address is B for Bill, and then my last name, Murray, and then the number 3 and the letters RD for third. So in other words, it's B. Murray 3RD, and that's at AOL.com. It's also what you'd use, Murray 3RD, to find me on LinkedIn and Facebook, by the way. My phone number, 323-552-6150. That's the main number for the organization because I'm the founder. But I'm only one of 30 people that put their phone numbers out, and as I say, if you want to speak to any of them, no skin off my nose, you know, you go to the contact page on the website and you'll find a whole bunch of other people, more than 2 dozen, who have their phone numbers and their email addresses in the public domain because they want to be resources for you. They're from all parts of the country. Yeah, and they're sitting ready to help.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on my show, and I do encourage anyone that if you're listening to the show and you have the issues that we've talked about, please give them a call. I've been involved with them. I've been on their radio show. They stand for excellence, and they're a wonderful organization. And, Bill, thank you so much again for being on my show, and I'm going to have you on again if you don't mind.
I'll come back anytime you want, and I just want to make one note, and that is that this this is not about Bill Murray. This is about us, and you're part of it. So it's a we thing, right? We are together in this.
Thank you so much, and you have a wonderful day.
Thanks. God bless and take care, and thanks, everybody, for being there.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
All right. That was Bill Murray, and he is the founder of National Association for Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, wonderful organization. I am Stacey Giovanni. I'm the owner of Lifetime Success for You. I am a survivor of child abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence. I specialize, I am a consulting hypnotist and a life coach. I specialize in working with abuse and addiction issues. I speak from a life experience and education level. You can get on my website at www.lifetimesuccess4u.com. And I hope that you join me again every week. I plan to have somebody that inspires and educates and is a wonderful a person to talk to. And if you would please be so kind as to join me again next week at noon on Thursday, Eastern Standard Time, we will have Bill Jurek, and he is a survivor of cancer. He's gone blind, I think about 19 years, and he's an advocate for people with disabilities and abuse. And he has a lot of information to talk about and share with us, so please do join us then. And as always, stay motivated and move forward. Have a great day. Bye-bye.